Hello, and welcome to The Analytic Angle, a podcast brought to you from the Statistics, Data Science, and Data Management Corps in the HIV Center at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and Columbia University. In this episode, we discuss how many measures to include when designing a study from our perspectives as data scientists. How many questionnaires are too many? Hi, this is Kale.
Hi, this is Martina.
And this is Richard.
Today we're going to talk about when one thinks about starting a study. How much should one measure? If we have a specific idea of what we want to measure, should we just measure that and be really controlled, or should we just add extra measurements about all possible things we might be interested in?
I think that's a good question. It partially depends on the type of the study that one is running, but also it's sort of a problem that we are very curious people and we would like to measure as much as possible, but we have to consider the burden on the subject and how much time it takes and how much money it costs.
I think it's a resource issue too.
You know,
if somebody manages to go through all the rigmarole to get a trial up and running and get the funding, it's like, we have this patient in front of us, let's collect everything we possibly can. But my curiosity is that, first of all, I have a superstition, perhaps, and maybe you can disabuse me of my superstition, that the more data you collect, the lower the quality of each individual datum. I mean, I think that's just human nature. If you have 10 questions to answer, you answer them thoughtfully, carefully, and with consideration. If you have 500 questions to answer, surely the thought and consideration of each question is not the same. Is that something you've seen in your work?
Yeah, we definitely do see that. There is a reality to that, absolutely. You can see this in studies that have been published that study that effect directly.
Mm-hmm.
And then just day-to-day, we also see this in data sets we collect where you will start to see patients, for instance, just skimming the last section of a survey by entering the same answer repeatedly. Sometimes you see those type of patterns. And for that reason, sometimes on longer surveys, they will have questions that refer to an earlier question to try to triangulate. And you'll notice that those later questions get just skipped or filled out identically to previous ones. So your superstition or your idea on that is absolutely correct. You can reach a point where you overburden a subject and they just aren't paying attention, if you will, anymore.
Yeah, this reminds me of the father of placebo effect, which was a late psychiatrist, Fred Kwitkin, who said it's very unfair to the subject in the study to be asked questions that are later not analyzed, and that it's practically an abuse, and that we have to be very careful by selecting what measures and what questions we ask the participants in order to guarantee the quality of the answers.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting because with the increase in technological ability, you know, something like just adding extra survey questions to an iPad app or adding extra response spaces to a database, Richard, it's not a big ask to do that technically. And so it gives researchers, I think, a false sense of, oh, it's just very easy to add a whole bunch of new things on. Why not do it, right?
So I have a question for you, Richard. Is it possible somehow through collecting the data, measure the quality of the answers by, for instance, measuring the amount of time between separate answers of the subject, when at the beginning of the questionnaire, maybe the subject really carefully thinks about all the questions and takes time to answer, but towards the end, is it possible somehow to measure that subject is just answering yes, 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 in very quick order, and that somehow used as a measure of quality of the answers?
Absolutely, you can do that. The question is, what do you do with that data you've obtained? Do you set a threshold for time of consideration? Do you eliminate outliers using a range of response times? But more importantly, to my mind, and to move on to another thing I want to talk about, we're not solely talking about patient responses here. We're also talking about data collected by research teams, which also, I think, has the same degradation in quality with a volume beyond a certain threshold. I'm not sure what that threshold is. It probably varies based on the size and expertise of the study team, but I do know that people abstracting data from medical records, which is largely the task of research teams, as opposed to, say, lab values, which are discrete. You can have as many values as you care to administer for the volume of specimens that you draw. But for other kinds of data which are collected by research teams, not direct responses by study participants, they have the same sort of degradation. And I'm not sure those measures are appropriate for that. So I think it seems to me in general that you want to limit the amount of data using some metric, but I'm curious what you might think that metric is.
That's a very interesting question. I don't think I can come up quickly with some metric, but mm-hmm. I think one has to really distinguish what kind of data are collected by research team, because I think not many data are actually collected by research team are used in like final analyses. Many of those data are rather a quality control and for managerial purposes of the research team. That, for instance, the PI wants to collect a certain things from the research team just to make sure that they did ask the question, they were present, they discussed for certain length with the subject, and it's rather measuring whether the study is being administered the same way throughout all those four or five years. Throughout the time by all different research assistants, and that the management of the study is running well. I'm not sure exactly like...
Well, I can give you an example. I know a number of studies, particularly in, say, emergency care, where outcome is dependent on subsequent admission or readmission. And those admissions can be categorized into different diagnoses, different causes of readmission, length of readmission, all those sorts of things, which some of which can be obtained by automatic means from scanning the electronic medical record, but some of which, particularly in outcomes that say fall between diagnoses or have certain qualifiers, require study team admission. And it seems logical to me that the more complex you make that, and the longer time you're measuring follow-up, so that, say, you're looking at a 5-year as opposed to a 1-year, all of those things can pose challenges for the quality of the data you're collecting.
Absolutely, you are correct. And if this is such an important measure that is measured and informing primary outcome, I strongly suggest have a double independent scorers of the measure that are actually scoring all the subjects, and then they are compared, and if their results disagree, there is some sort of a concilium or some sort of a final judgment done on how is it going to be that particular subject judged.
So it sounds like we're in agreement then that we don't want to just add an endless number of measures, that there's diminishing returns to the quality of the data, and as a result of the quality of the study or the test, the analyses that are going to come out of that data. But then what's on the other side here? We probably don't just suggest measuring one thing. Do we have any ideas about how to target or what kind of number of measures is a sweet spot for a particular study?
Just to play devil's advocate, why wouldn't we measure just one thing? Mightn't that lead to more efficient trials? Mightn't that lead to iterative trials instead of having a trial that tries to measure a number of things at once?
Well, if I might answer, I think measuring just one thing will leave us open to potential criticism that this particular measure maybe didn't really measure what we are looking for. So we are always looking for a second or third measure that would support our feeling that that one particular measure, like measure for depression, is the score for depression, is really measuring what we are looking for in that particular study. However, again, I wouldn't say we have to be very careful what supportive measures we select, one or two, and how they are being used. If this is only to support as a secondary analysis or as an exploratory analysis, this primary measure actually did measure what we are looking for, or whether it is just for our internal purposes to see whether there is a correlation between the primary measure and the second measure.
Yeah, I also think it makes sense, and it seems like we're all targeting kind of a clinical trial or a trial type environment here, mm-hmm. in which you're hoping that your treatment and placebo groups are balanced because of randomization. I think you still want to be collecting enough data that you're going to have evidence that there didn't seem to be something wrong with the randomization, that you don't have really imbalanced groups, because it is important to be able to have some kind of secondary information about patients so that if you need to do some sort of statistical adjustment later, you can. And so I think it makes sense, as Martina was saying, to have a couple measures for your primary outcome, and then maybe a couple measures that might be related to the outcome in some other way.
So, Kale, when you're talking about these measures, are you actually hinting that there might be potential confounders of the study, and we should think about them and measure them just in case if we are having a question whether the study could potentially be confounded, that we can look at those measures and determine whether there are differences between those two groups, treatment and placebo?
Yeah, that is what I was getting at, is just the idea that perhaps there's something else driving an effect that we observe. And if we don't measure other things that might be tied to the effect, then there's no way for us to go and check. If a reviewer or a fellow scientist brings up, hey, is it possible that there's this other thing behind the groups, we would want to be able to go and check that.
But that seems to address both of the topics that we're sort of addressing here, both in terms of data quality and in terms of sussing out of confounders, as it were. But it sounds like the recommendation would be to have secondary measures or confirmatory measures in different modalities as the primary measure. You don't want to have two self-report surveys, even though they might be correlated generally, in order to be a primary, one to be a secondary. You want a behavioral measure, an observational measure, a biochemical measure, something on a different axis.
I absolutely agree. I think in nowadays day and age, we have a lot of different modalities available to us, and we do not have to just collect answers from the subject. And we can maybe support the questionnaires that is subject given on the visit with text messages that are being sent every night, or some sort of a timeline follow-back measure, or completely different biological measures that could be supportive.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point and well taken. I mean, what's maybe a challenge with that is that often when you have one type of modality set up, it's really easy to add other things of that modality. So if you have the survey set up, it's very easy to just add more questions. And so maybe we want to resist that temptation and instead focus, as you said, on some other modality.
Yeah, we've pinpointed or gone around the pitfalls of that. But so it makes sense to me now, we've sort of established the data collection through the primary and secondary outcomes, the planned analyses. But surely, you know, again, there's the desire is I have this patient in front of me. I don't want to waste this scarce and valuable resource. I'm going to collect all sorts of things which might be related, but not necessarily contributing to a primary, secondary, even tertiary analysis. Exploratory aims, circumstantial aims, information regarding these potential confounders and the quality and nature of those. That's, I think, where the danger zone begins in terms of quantity of data.
And this is a good point, and I think this is why it's very important to involve statisticians and data scientists right at the beginning of thinking about the trial that can potentially sort of, you know, warn the scientists about the pitfalls, and that we really shouldn't think about what we can collect, but only the groups that we have reason to collect, which are the primary, secondary outcomes, potentially confounders, and maybe some measures that help us to manage the study from the beginning to the end. But that should be pretty much it. What do you think?
I think that that's a good response to this issue. I mean, we weren't able to identify a number. There probably will never be a way to identify a number. But I think pushing back against just adding more and more, even when that seems is easy, is a good way to go.
And that's the response to people who say, well, given this circumstance, I don't want to waste the opportunity to collect this data, is, I think, the point we initially began with, which is that at some point, an undetermined point, but nevertheless a discernible one, where the more data you collect, the overall level of quality can decline.
And this concludes another episode of our podcast, The Analytic Angle, from the Statistics, Data Science, and Data Management Core in HIV Center for Clinical and Behavioral Studies.